The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
We got my good friend Kurt Zehner here today. Kurt and I go back quite a few years pre-pandemic. So my memory, we first met in Hawaii at a conference. Kurt's memory is different than that because Kurt was just standing there with his lovely wife and he was new to the conference of the Western Trial Lawyers in Hawaii. And, you know, I try to make people feel welcome. So I said, welcome, say, hi, my name's Dan. Welcome to Western Trial Lawyers. And Kurt, what'd you tell me?
I said, Dan, we've met several times.
And I said, well, let's just start over then. But you said it with a very hurt tone, like you were hurt that I didn't remember you.
I was.
And you were hurt. You know what, though, dude? What could I say? You're a sensitive guy. People don't know this about Kurt Zehner. For all the, you know, big swords he swings around and big verdicts, very sensitive guy. But we got past that, and we did a live case analysis in Denver on one of your electrocution cases, so that was pretty cool.
We did.
That was pretty fun. That's how I got past Kurt's obstructive personality. He was mean to me at first because I didn't remember him. Then I said, hey, do you want to do a conference in Denver all about your trial and your verdict? And he's like, sounds like fun to me. And we got past it. And since then, Kurt has been I think you've come to most of my conferences. You're at Huntington Beach last year. You're at both Vegas conferences.
Yep, New York.
This year, New York.
Yeah.
So we're getting more refined with our conference skills and hopefully they've been enjoyable. You meet lots of new people, make lots of new friends. I know you really helped out Joe Gutierrez and Jason Myers, who had a CRPS case against one of the big hotels here, MGM. They got a great verdict, 8-figure verdict, over $20 million. So they were very happy about you.
Yeah.
So that's great. And so anyways, Kurt, that's enough backstory. So let's talk about you for a minute, Kurt. So you've been practicing law for how long?
I did a federal clerkship in 2006. And by the way, before we go there, back to Hawaii, I think I'd met you probably half a dozen times. But I wasn't remarkable enough. I didn't have the big verdicts or big enough verdicts yet for Dan to remember me. But then I had a new one to tell you about. And Dan, you've been just so kind ever since. We've had a lot of fun, a lot of laughs, a couple fights because I am sensitive. I think that's what makes me a better human and a better trial lawyer. You know, I think it's what helps the tears come in trial a lot because I cry so often on my own and people are mean to me. So I take that skill and I transfer it. That was like 7-8 years ago.
So you said you did a federal clerkship in 2006.
2006,
that's right. And so then 2007, you went into the actual practice of law. Is that right?
That's right. Practice of law, this was down in, I was clerking in federal district court in West Palm Beach. That was an incredible journey. I mean, it was a big shocker. Law school, you're in school, what, like 4 hours a day? That's like your hardest day. I loved law school. Do whatever you want. Trial team, hang out, chase girls, whatever. And then you're in like a federal clerkship. And it's like, oh, that's a great job. And I was like, is it? I'm behind a desk for 8.5 hours a day. And it was a brutal transition becoming like part of the workforce and like sitting down. I mean, my judge literally caught me sleeping at my desk one time and he just smiled because he took naps at work too, and which was cool. So the clerkship thing was really cool. I learned how to write, which was, I think we can talk about that later, probably one of the most important tools we have as trial lawyers. Often overlooked that we need to focus on. I got to watch what worked in trial and in court in front of judges and in front of juries. And I started learning that we are professional communicators. That's what we do. And it depends on who you're communicating to as to how you want to communicate. Different styles are effective for different audiences, judges, juries, et cetera. So I did that for a year and it was great, man. It was a blast.
Well, but you didn't always have this trial lawyer thing at the top of your agenda of what you wanted to become when you grew up. So, you know, I know you at one point you moved out to California to be an actor. So give us a little bit of your backstory of how you got actually to law school.
Yeah. So yeah, you're right. I wanted to be a movie star, to steal a line from Swingers. I thought they were handing out sitcoms at the airport. Apparently not. Becoming an actor is a pretty tough thing to do. A lot of credit to those that make it. I packed up my Isuzu Rodeo and went out there and I did all the obligatory LA actor things you have to do. I slept on a buddy's couch. you know, for 3 months until I could find a place with some random roommate from Bulgaria. Super nice guy. I pounded the pavement to try and get a bartending job. Those are not easy to get in LA because everyone thinks you're going to go to LA, get a bartending job, and then become a movie star. So I got that. And then I got into an acting class. And you have to audition in LA to get into the good acting classes. You don't just get to sign up. So I was like, when did my sales? I'm in a cool acting class. Got my headshots done. Got an agent. And then I was like, yeah, do I really want to do this? Because, I mean, you've been out in LA. It's a tough place, Dan. And it's more about who you know than what you know. I was getting frustrated. I was like, I don't care if I'm the best actor. And I probably wasn't. But that wouldn't guarantee I could do well. And I realized that all the people, I loved the movies. That's why I wanted to be an actor. And I realized, I had this epiphany, that I didn't want to be the actor playing the guy in the movie. I wanted to be the guy in the movie. I wanted to be William Wallace saving the day. I wanted to be Kevin Lomax making the right decision in Devil's Advocate. I wanted to be the great trial lawyer helping out the people. So I realized I wouldn't want to pretend. I wanted to be in real life. And so I decided to go back to law school.
When did you first realize I have an inkling to become a lawyer?
I think it was high school. I liked arguing. I liked debating. I liked giving speeches. All those things terrified me, but I was always able to overcome those nerves and deliver good speeches. And then I'd finish a speech. I'd be like, what just happened? Where was I? Kind of an old school moment. I volunteered at this juvenile court where kids who committed crimes could go to the juvie court, have little kid lawyers, 17, 18 years old, represent them and do like a little mock trial. And they get like, I don't know, diversion, counseling, community service. And I loved it, man. Put my suit and tie on, went in there, I argued. And I was like, I think I want to do this. And so it was acting trial lawyer back and forth. And I knew acting had to go first because I was more exciting, frankly, becoming a movie star.
Really?
I mean, I think a lot less work than what we do now daily. But in LA, I was like, you know what? I can take all these things I like about acting, performing, and being in front of people, and I can do that in the world of trial law. And I can be the writer and the actor and the director all at the same time as a trial lawyer. And that script changes on the fly, as you know, Dan, in trial. Everything's changing. Evidence comes in, evidence comes out. So it's almost like for the intelligent actor, you've got to play all those roles. And that was really appealing to me.
So how do you think that year in Hollywood and acting classes and bartending, but that year helped form the foundation of you going to law school and becoming the trial lawyer you are?
Yeah, I think, you know, I took acting classes in college and so was in a play and all that. And then I wasn't just like the first time doing it. So it was a culmination of 4 years in college, a year in Los Angeles. And I get asked a lot. And look, I wasn't like a big movie star. I can't give you any good roles I was in. It was just, I was doing the process. But that in itself was really valuable to me. It's just becoming comfortable in front of people and becoming able to emote. I don't pretend, I don't act in the courtroom. I believe in my clients. I believe in the case. I believe in the righteousness of it. I believe in the reprehensible conduct of the defendant. And so I'm just able to better connect with my own emotions and be more authentic in front of a jury, in front of a judge, being able to just go into the moment and be there. And I like that about trial law as opposed to acting is that I don't have to like memorize a script. That always stressed me out in acting. Am I going to remember all my lines? I just speak from the heart as a trial lawyer, and I write my openings, closings, and all that. But it's nice having that flexibility and that freedom to be able to just say what you need to say in the moment. And I love that. So I think acting was a huge part. And the bartending, too. It's a really good point you bring up, Dan, because being in the service industry, I mean, as a waiter, as a bartender, I mean, you are communicating with people. And that's what I was saying earlier. That's what we do. We communicate. And being able to deal with high pressure, angry customers, happy customers, dealing with lots of customers, running food. I mean, those are essential skills for what we do as trial lawyers because you're dealing with people. And so I think the bartending, the acting, the serving, it was all helpful in developing interpersonal people skills, which are really at the root of what we do as trial lawyers.
You do your year out there in Hollywood and you decide you want to go to law school.
Yeah.
So where do you head to for law school?
I was going to go to USC and I accepted the whole thing, but I realized I didn't really like Los Angeles. I like Hermosa Beach. Too long of a commute. Hermosa Beach is really cool. So I went back to University of Florida. Yeah, that's where I got my undergrad as well. So I'm a double gator, proud of it. And law school was a blast, man. Trial team, law review, hanging out, like I was saying, running around, taking undergrad classes. It was a lot of fun.
I can only imagine how much fun that was at Florida, because I went to school at Detroit College of Law in the ghetto of Detroit with security guards everywhere just to get your car back. I couldn't wait to get out. Let's just say that wasn't like, this is the greatest time ever. I'm like, whatever classes I don't have to go to, I will skip. If they don't take attendance, I will skip. If there's somebody who can give me their outlines, I will take them, because all I want to do is get the hell out of that law school. But I did survive it and did get out, which is important. So you go to law school, you have the time of your life for 3 years, you do your federal clerkship, and then what's the next move from there? Because you did a federal clerkship, you told me, because you were interested in becoming a federal prosecutor.
Yeah, that was my dream. I wanted to become a federal prosecutor. I didn't want to do the big law thing. I didn't want to bill hours, and I didn't want to just lose my soul working, sleeping in the office. And I mean, I had a friend that took a big law job, and her job for like 3 years was defending some government that shot down a passenger plane and like killed everybody on board. And they were trying to collect against them, and she was defending them. And that's how she spent her minutes on the earth. And I was like, I don't want to do that. So I didn't go the big law route, but I want to be a federal prosecutor. I knew that the federal clerkship was kind of like the first stepping stone. You're supposed to go to big law after that, but I thought maybe I could find a way around it. And I went and I worked at this firm called Kozak Tropin down in Miami. Really like high-level boutique litigation firm, class action stuff, some PI, commercial litigation. And my mentor there was one of the most famous former federal prosecutors in the nation. He prosecuted these Cuban spies. And so he kind of mentored me. And I tried to get that job as a federal prosecutor. I interviewed several times. And they said, no, my experience wasn't good enough. They're like, Kurt, we like you. We like your energy. But we just hired this other guy. And he was a quarterback at Columbia, Yale Law School, clerk for the 11th Circuit. So he was slightly more qualified. So I didn't get the job.
What was that like to face rejection for maybe one of the first times in your life?
Yeah. Well, acting prepares you for that. You get a lot of rejection from acting, which is great. But it was tough, man. Like, it sucks losing. So what did I do? I quit my job for like 10 months and stopped being a lawyer.
And what'd you do?
I bought a one-way ticket to South America, and I backpacked in Argentina and Uruguay and Chile. And I was like, what do I want to do with my life? I applied to JAG. I'm like, I'll become a state prosecutor. I want to move to Colorado, where there's like mountains and it's good weather. So I was there. I was out of work for 9 months, decided, okay, we'll try law again. And then I got a job as a criminal defense attorney, as you can appreciate, with this guy, Harvey Steinberg in Colorado, who does all the high-profile Bronco cases. So that was literally trial by fire, man. It was a blast. I did that for a year.
So you practiced criminal law for 1 year with a big-time lawyer. Well, why'd you leave him? It was such a great gig. You're working on big-time shit.
So it was equal parts exciting and maddening. At 7:30 a.m., you show up at the office, and he's like, all right, Zahner, you're going to this court over there. And then at 10 a.m., you're going to go to this other court. And then you go unprepared. What's the case about? What's happening? You know, you show up, and the guy's like, you're not my lawyer. Harvey's my lawyer. I was like, well, I'm your lawyer today. And so you deal with that. That was stressful. And then you go back for lunch, and then it's like, all right, Kurt, you're going to this court at 1:30. So it was cool, man. I got to go to all these courts. I got all this experience. I tried my first 10 cases. But man, it was stressful. And getting a trial the night before. Here you go, Kurt. You got trial tomorrow at 7:30 a.m. What's the case about? These aren't huge cases. You know, I was a baby lawyer, but it was tough, man. And I remember one time I showed up to a court in Jefferson County, Colorado, and my client is in the box, right? He's in the jury. He's in chains in prison. He's in handcuffs. And he's going for sentencing. I didn't know he was going for sentencing. And I was like, Judge, can I continue this? My boss gets here. She's like, no, Mr. Steinberg has continued this 4 times. We're going to go today with sentencing. I said, well, can I go at least talk to my client? Not really, sir. He's obviously in the box. You can try and talk to him, but good luck. I couldn't get a chance to talk to him and learn some mitigation. I didn't know what went into the plea deal ahead of time. I didn't know how we got here, what was agreed to. And the kid got led away to federal prison. And I was just like, I just felt like I wasn't helping people. I didn't like being in that position. So I was like, I'm done, man. I can't practice law like this. And I took another 10 months off and searched my soul whether I want to become a lawyer again, if I wanted to give up, man, because it was hard.
Man, you've done a lot of soul searching, Zahner. You're like spiritually, like the spiritual trial lawyer.
It goes with my sensitivity hand in hand.
I know. So another 10 months of dicking around, then what'd you decide to do? How'd you dick around for this 10 months? Did you go to South America?
Yeah, I went to Scotland for a month and I retraced William Wallace's steps. You seen the movie Braveheart? You got the Braveheart sword behind me. You know, I went to like the battlefields and like I would journal and I would pray and I'd listen to the soundtrack and I was like, drink whiskey. Like, what do I want to do with my life? What do I want to be? I went to a bunch of college football games and I was like, I finally came after a lot of praying and soul searching. I was like, I really want to try this trial lawyer thing as a personal injury trial lawyer. So I ended up getting a job at like the big mill law firm here in town. There's nothing wrong with mills. There's big advertisers. They're great. And I was there for about 3 months. And I was like, I don't like this. And so I quit. And
I heard the story from the mill operator. He's like, that Zahner came here, learned everything, took one of my best guys and started his own firm.
You know, it's like Obi-Wan Kenobi says. It's like, that's true from a certain point of view. But I didn't take him. He joined me, one of the associates there, and we started Zahner Hardin Law about a year after I left. And ever since then, man, we've been going strong for 12 years, been blessed with a lot of success. We've been doing all, we started doing criminal defense. I remember we signed up a DUI case, and the fee was $3,000, and we were through the freaking roof. Like, yeah, we got some money in the door.
We're going to be paying the rent this month.
Yeah.
Somebody trusted me with some money. This is great.
This is cash. Do I have to declare it?
I know. Trust. All depends on how honest you are, Zahner.
And it grew, man. We were able to phase out of the criminal defense and do car crash cases. And then cases came to us that nobody wanted. That's how you have to make a name for yourself. And I ended up getting these really terrible cases that I believed in. And we started hitting verdicts on them. We hit a case on this DUI case. This guy, you can see his name plaque behind me, Ghaffar Al-Hillo. This guy was going 88 miles per hour on a 40 mile per hour street road, city road, 88 miles per hour. And this other guy turns left in front of him. And it's all caught on video. And the 88 mile per hour motorcyclist, he hits the window, the passenger window behind the driver. And his head goes like right into that back window. And there's a guy sitting in that seat. And it knocks that guy out and gives him a brain injury. And that guy's bleeding. But the motorcycle driver then falls back. And he dies right on the road. It's all caught on tape. And the guy driving the Jeep that hit him or blocked his path just kept driving. And he stopped about two parking lots away, looked at his buddy in the back with the brain injury and the blood screaming down, looked at his friend in the other seat, and he took off running. By his own account, he ran 16 miles with two broken ribs, left behind beer, vodka, and marijuana, and waited 3 days to turn himself into police. The police never charged him with causing the crash. Nobody wanted to touch this case. And I was like, we'll give it a shot because I believed in this family. And it was this wonderful Muslim family. They remember they had us over during trial prep during Ramadan where they're fasting and we're invited in and they cooked this feast for us. And they were just like the most beautiful family. They kept his room downstairs. I mean, losing a child, he was 25 years old. Losing a child is just one of the most difficult things you can do. And they kept his room how it was. They kept the Quran playing on loop. He was looking down watching and they would tell us about that. And so that was our first big case. We won it. Jury, I couldn't ask for money because the mom didn't want me to. She didn't want Ghaffar to look down from heaven and think that we were valuing his life. So we didn't ask for an amount. And the jury gave us $2.5 million, went front page of Denver Post, hit and run driver, held accountable. They put 55% blame on the driver. And so it was a huge win. And then it was just off to the races from there.
What year was that?
It's like 2014, 2015, 2015, I think.
The case sounds very familiar. Did we ever do a case analysis on that one? Sounds very familiar.
We did. Yeah, we did.
That's why it sounds familiar. I'm like, this sounds like a set of facts that I know.
Yes.
All right. All right. So you represented the poor family, the Muslim that got killed in this motorcycle accident. But then from there, because when we met, you were talking about some electrocution case in CRPS, right?
Yeah. So then we got another dog. There's this case where this young man, he was a flooring installer and he's installing floors at a new house. The house hasn't been completely built and he's going to get power out of the power outlet at a new house. All the power's outside. There's like a temporary power box and he plugs in his machine and boom, it's a big explosion. And he gets like burns, they don't last, but like black marks on his hand, develops something called complex regional pain syndrome, which is a terrible neurological nervous system condition, which affects your autonomic nervous system, causes your body. Your autonomic nervous system is supposed to do things like regulate heat and cold. It activates when you have fight or flight. It's not supposed to carry pain signals. It's just supposed to help regulate things. Well, when someone comes down with complex regional pain syndrome, it now becomes a pain carrier. The nervous system goes haywire, and it keeps going haywire and starts sending pain signals where it's not supposed to. And every time you're hot, you're cold, fight or flight, it just keeps going out of whack, and the pain keeps coming. And then it spreads oftentimes from one limb to the next, to the next, to the next, which is what our guy had. But the problem in this case is that the company who put that electrical box out there, they destroyed it and they disposed of it. And so we couldn't prove our case. And so this guy had a lawyer, a very good lawyer in town. He withdrew from the case 2 months before the statute of limitations expired. And a paralegal brought it to us. She's like, you want to give it a shot? And I met Brian, the client. I just fell in love with the guy. He was father of three boys. I had one child, one boy at the time. I now have three boys.
So you're trying to be like Brian, huh?
Yeah. Your clients become your heroes. They really do, because they have these like awful hands dealt to them, and they're resilient and they survive. And they find, like, I complain about my hamstring pain and I'm like, my clients lose their legs. Who am I to complain?
You're flying around the world getting stem shots because your little shoulder hurts you.
Yeah, right. I get a little pain in my neck. I want some more stem cells. So we took the case and I was like, we just got to win that spoliation motion. I'm sure the spoliation law is great in Colorado. It was not great in Colorado. It is now because of this case. And we were able, through deposition testimony, we got them to create like four different stories of when they destroyed the box, and just looked like we called it a moving fiction. They kept changing the date and deposition and this and interrogatory answer. So we're like, Judge, they're lying about this. We can't tell when they destroyed it. So you have to give them sanctions. And we ended up getting an irrebuttable presumption of causation and liability, meaning the jury had to find at least 1% fault and causation on the part of the defendants. And they never offered the policy limits. They thought they were going to be just fine. They offered like $700,000. After week one of trial, they offered the policy.
What was the policy?
$3 million. We said too late. And the jury came back with $16
million. All right. That's it. It's a good thing, because it would look bad if they came back with two.
Oh, yeah, that would be bad. Still the largest. We have little verdicts here in Colorado. I'm trying to change that. That was the teeny tiny. That's still the largest premises liability verdict in Colorado history. Went up to appeal, 62 pay. I got to argue with the Court of Appeals. It was so cool. It was just a bummer because it was on Zoom because of the pandemic. And we got a 62-page published opinion, which is now the law about spoliation in Colorado. So it was great, man. All sorts of media. Brian got paid $16 million. It was just, his life has changed. He's in warm weather now. It was just a wonderful story, man.
Wow. Check this out. Just on a side note.
You know what you got?
There's a guy hanging outside my window.
Oh, man.
Just share that with you.
I can't do that. Heights.
That's a fucking height there. It's only about 220 feet off the ground. But
you do that, dude?
Because I used to go up like 30, 40 feet on ladders. I was never hanging from roofs.
It's pretty high.
That was life risking stuff for me as a house painter for 20 years. You learn about hard labor. I wish I had taken your time off and traveled. That'd have been more enlightening, but not everybody was born so fortunate, Mr. Zahner. Some people had to pilk themselves up. I know.
I laid carpet one summer. That was hard, dude.
No.
Yes.
Dude, I can imagine. Woo. I asked you that.
Yeah, and built character.
This labor stuff's not for me. I got to do something with it. I got a brain. I got to do something with it.
And it's like your clients, a lot of them are blue collar, and it was just good to like have that experience. So you know what they're going through. And then the pain, we have pain and we can't sit at our desk and my neck hurts. They have pain. They can't do their job, man. And it's like, it's a big deal. Even like just whiplash pain, big deal.
Yeah, but they got to do it anyway, so they don't get paid. That's the problem.
Right. They got to put food on the table.
Got to suffer.
That's right.
Switching gears, you recently had a gas explosion, or what it was, fracking tank, which we were just talking about yesterday. Just tell me about it. Because like, I'm just fascinated by this case because this was your first explosion gas kind of case. Is that right?
That's right. You got to be a creative marketer of your own brand. And so we were the electrical explosion guys. And so this case came into Colorado and they're like, oh, Zahner's the explosion guy. I know I had no oil and gas experience, but fake it till you make it, right? And so this case comes in a couple of years ago. I think it was a referral from California. Never done an oil and gas case. I don't know what knockout pots do. I still don't really know what a knockout pot does. I have a better idea. And I go to Denver Health Hospital and I meet the client who's been airlifted there. And he's got external fixators all over his body, his hips and his legs. His beard's all burned off. He's like this grisly oil and gas worker. And what had happened was he was at this fracking site and you have at a fracking site what's called frack tanks. They look like mobile homes. Good way to picture it. And when you're fracking things out of the ground, oil and gas and water, the oil and the water come back into and get deposited in those tanks. They're like storage tanks. They're called vapor-tight tanks. That'll be important. And Steve is the night supervisor, my client, Steve Strawn, who is just, again, a sweetheart of a guy. He was an Air Force veteran who volunteered to go fight in Fallujah with the Marines while he was waiting for his top secret clearance. And then he ended up handling our nuclear weapons and like fixing them and like taking them apart. Super smart guy, super manly, very adventurous. He hiked to the base camp of Nepal many times. So he loved being physical. He got into oil and gas when he got out of the military because he loved just like the excitement, the adrenaline rush of like having to like think about stuff as a supervisor and use your body at the same time, pounding things away, fixing that, hearing gauges, seeing things happen, reacting on the fly. And dude, he was awesome at it. He's actually now an expert in other oil and gas cases because of our case. He met our expert and got him a job. But anyway, he's at the site. It's nighttime. It's cold. Him and his coworker, they hear some crinkling noises. And that's not uncommon on an oil and gas site because it gets cold in Colorado and these tanks with hot oil in them, they crinkle, they expand, they pop. He gets on one of the tanks because he hears another noise and he has his coworker go on top of the tank next to him. And he's like, you know, that tank's full of oil. If you could just shut that valve off just in case anything is happening, we don't want the one tank with oil to, I don't know, be involved. Thank God he did this. As soon as he does that, his partner turns off the valve in the oil tank, kind of isolating it. Steve is on top of a water tank next to him, and it explodes, like explosion. Steve is launched 30, 40, 50 feet into the air. He lands about 30 feet away from the tank he was on. He testifies he sees the city lights of Denver 60 miles away, and all I can think about as he's in the air is like, don't land on my head. Don't land on my head. And he doesn't. He lands on his legs, and he suffers severe orthopedic injuries. Tibia fractures the top and the bottom. That's the bone between your knee and your foot. Open book pelvic fracture where your pelvis opens up like a book, cracks completely in half, and TBI that gets untreated for about a year, all sorts of stuff, man. And so he goes through this awful recovery. A year later, ends up getting rid of his leg because it's just causing too much pain. He's got like neuropathy. He's got neuropathic pain, which is what you get when you have CRPS. And he had, his foot was like bent out of shape. So he amputates his leg. He can't mountain bike. He can't mountaineer. He can't sail with his kids. He had a two-year-old and a two-month-old at the time of the explosion. He can't work in oil. I mean, his whole life is just completely shattered, like his body. And I'm like, well, got to figure out what happened here, man. Why the heck did this thing explode? And that was the challenge.
So taking this because help run your firm, you got these other cases. So you got this monstrous case with a guy who's catastrophically injured with an area that you're not familiar with. So tell us, how do you go about attacking this challenge of figure out what happened and finding the right experts and whatever the process it is, because just the sound of it. Because I think that I was just talking with a buddy of mine this morning about your case. I think the vast majority of us would go find like a panish or somebody that's done this before multiple times, kind of ride their coattails, let them kind of guide us through it. Very few people are going to sit there and be like, okay, I can do this. I can handle this. I can learn how to do this. And I can set all this aside and still be a father to my three kids, a husband to my wife, and have a life and learn this shit. So tell us how you go about attacking this case to figure out what happened and how you're going to explain it to a jury.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of that the delusional self-belief we talked about earlier. I was like, I mean, fuck, I can do this, right? Like, I'm smart. I work hard. I'm confident in my ability. I just got to learn it. You got to walk a tightrope because I don't want my client to figure out I don't know what I'm doing. So he's dropping like nomenclature, knockout pods, vent lines, you know, the separators. I was like, I don't know, man. You know, like you just got to fake it till you make it. So I start interviewing experts. I call my buddies who have done some of these oil and gas cases and I get like a list of experts. Petroleum engineers are incredibly expensive. Just word of them. I mean, they're like, you know, I don't want to be like one of those Med-Mal guys who's like, you can't do Med-Mal because the experts are too expensive. But these guys, petroleum engineers, are really expensive. And so I interviewed like four or five of them. And I was like, look, I got to be honest. I don't know what I'm doing. I need you to educate me. And so we hired one, we fired one. Finally found the guy we liked from Texas. So we got a-
Hold on, let me ask you, what criteria, like if you're trying to find an expert in a field where you are not familiar with, how do you go about trying to figure out who's the right guy to help you on this particular case?
It's like you said, you start calling the people you trust that, know this, and you tell them what you're looking for, you get your names. And then when you call them, like I said, you got to be brutally honest and be like, I don't really know what's happening. I got a great track record in other cases. I'm going to need you to educate me. And they got to be on board with that. And they can't be like these pompous jerks. You got to find someone who's humble, who is kind, who is patient, and just like everything else in life. To find right people by judging whether they're kind and patient and humble. And so we did that, and it wasn't the cheapest. John Hewitt, great man, he is an all-star. And then I realized, well, wait, so he's what's called a petroleum engineer. He can talk about what happens at an oil and gas site. Again, I'm learning this from him. He's like, you probably need a cause and explosion guy too. I go, what's that? Someone can say why this thing exploded. So I had to get, I found a chemist in Colorado, Sean Sapp, who's a cause and origin explosion guy. And he was fellow Florida Gator. You can see my orange and blue Gator sunset behind me in the stadium. Ben Hill Griffin.
Spectacular.
Chomp, chomp, baby. I got him on board. Then Sarah, my colleague who works with me, she found a consulting expert locally who was, this is a great idea, a younger petroleum engineer who had no expert experience. We do this sometimes. We like, in cases, we'll call, we'll look in Google and try and find people in the field that we think we need an expert in and just call them and say, hey, do you want to be an expert? And those people are great because they have no baggage. They have no history. In the electrocution case, we got two of these guys as our experts. We started calling up flooring installers and found this grizzly old guy. He's like, I'll tell you what flooring installers usually do and what's normal, because it was a big comparative default defense in that, saying that our flooring guy didn't do the right thing. So we did this. We found a petroleum engineer who was local, and he ended up helping us out and really spending the time with us we needed, like drawing diagrams. This is fracking 101. This is what the knockout pot is. This is what the separators work. This is the incinerator. And we had him on our beck and call. And he was this guy, Mark. He was amazing. And he was so amazing that he got engaged to Sarah, my colleague who was working on the case. And now, you know, they're off traveling the world, which is great for them. I've lost her now for a year. But I'm very happy for them. So it was meeting after meeting, Dan, and learning the ABCs, then trying to figure out what happened. Then we got some OSHA reports, which shed some light. Then we ended up talking to the other companies that were on site there. They did some investigations, so we got their investigations. And it was just, but I can tell you this, by the time I got to trial and I cross-examined their petroleum engineer expert, I knew so much about fracking that I was able to flip him to our side. And everyone on that jury thought that I knew more than him, because I could talk the talk and then use all my dramatic skills to really embellish things. And we put it together, man. We put it together and we figured out our theory of liability.
That is good that you did that. And I'm going to talk about it a little bit more. I'm going to shift gears real quickly now, because we're going to talk more trial stuff, actual substantive stuff, not just the war stories of how you figure shit out, which some people like, I say war stories with a negative connotation. I'm like, I love war stories. I love their stories of people that figure shit out and got some big justice. People that don't like those stories, I'm like, I can't understand it. I really can't. Because I think maybe some of them don't like the stories because they can never picture themselves in that story, right?
Right.
That story happened to them. Because like when you tell these stories, like I picture, obviously, people that are there, like, I picture that happening for me.
Right.
You know, I don't know if I could figure all this shit out like you did. I might have somebody figure it out like that, then have me come in. So you figure out, I'm better at that part of it.
You could do it. And the happy ending of this thing is after 2 weeks, the jury came back with a big fat verdict, the biggest one we've ever had. And they pinned 20% fault on other parties. So we got knocked down a little bit, which was fine. I mean, the whole case was about whether, I mean, here's the key to complex cases that Mark Lanier talks about. Make them simple. Make them simple and tell the jury, hey, good news for you in opening. This is going to be a simple case. And what we made the case about was these tanks. We said, look, this tank company had one job and one job only, and that was to deliver a vapor-tight tank to the oil field. Vapor-tight means no holes. But the problem is they provided tanks with tiny little pinholes, holes about the size of a quarter, and holes about the size of, I don't know, a pipe about, I'm holding my hands up, about, I don't know, 3-inch diameter. And that's what allowed this, they allowed oxygen into this whole system, which created a flammable explosive mixture, which caused the explosion. The jury came back and said 80% their fault. These guys felt very confident in all their non-party defenses. They thought we were going to get zeroed out. And they brought in a fancy trial lawyer 2 weeks before, which happens that has happened in some of my cases. Very talented guy, Derek McKay. And they thought they were going to win this thing. Jury came back with $30 million, take away 20% for non-parties. It was a great result. Of course, we're now in the post-trial motion and just got noticed yesterday. They're asking for a new trial for four different reasons and all the bad things I said that were violative of rules. So we'll see how that plays out. But I feel pretty confident.
Great. And we're going to see each other soon in Huntington Beach in June. And you were in Huntington Beach last year. So just let's be honest. Was that your favorite conference you ever been to in your life?
Dude, it was the best.
It was my favorite conference.
Dude, I'm not just blowing smoke. I've been really involved with AAJ over the years. I was like the new lawyer president for like a couple of years, and I do all these things. Dude, the Huntington Beach one, it was on the beach, super chill. Everyone's down to earth. I end up going for beach runs, doing some of my Kempo karate drills on the beach in the morning. I show up to breakfast with no shoes on after my beach run, and no one gives me shit. It was great. Sat down, got my tank top on, making friends, eating eggs, getting my morning protein dose. It was a blast. We brought our cold plunge to the seminar, got a big bucket of ice, and we all jump in it in the middle of the day. Dude, it was a blast, man. It was actually fun. It wasn't like stuffy or stressful, and there's so much to do. I mean, I was speaking a lot, but I also caught some other folks, and that was awesome. I mean, you just bring people that have big verdicts, which I think is what people want to hear from. That's what I want to hear from. How do I replicate it? How do I create that magic? So it was awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. This year, we got it going June 5th through 8th. We got 4 lecture tracks and 8 workshop tracks. And I know that you'll be teaching it. So what are you going to be teaching? Because I know we just talked about this 15-minute voir dire. So you might want to adjust one of your presentations because so many people get 15, 20 minutes for voir dire, whether in federal court. Some state courts are really hardcore like that too. And that's what you had in this case with your gas explosion. And we're going to talk about that in a bit. But tell us what you're going to teach in Huntington Beach. I know you got 2 lectures and 1 workshop, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. We might add another workshop. But yeah, so the first lecture is what you've kind of identified, how to do voir dire in 15 minutes, which is all we get in Colorado. That's the presumptive number in Colorado. For this case in federal court, the explosion one, it was 15 minutes. And like you go to all these seminars and great trial lawyers talk about all these things you can do. I know you teach great voir dire. But sometimes you have limited time and I still use some of your stuff even in the 15 minutes, but how do you do that? So I've given this to Colorado trial lawyers because it's a problem we deal with all the time. And so I'm doing 1 lecture on how to do voir dire in 15 minutes and how to ask for 8 figures, both in voir dire and then in closing different formulas. So kind of like, you know, a double hit there. I think that will be a lot of fun. I've given the speech before. It was pretty well received.
Hopefully you're refining the presentation. So this is like your A game. You practice locally with it and then you roll it out for the national stage. Is that what I hear?
Oh, that's right, man. If I hadn't gotten any better since when I gave this, 3 years ago, then who am I as trial lawyer? This great line from Kingdom of Heaven. What man is a man that doesn't make the world a better place? What trial lawyer is a trial lawyer that doesn't improve and try and seek to improve his craft? So yeah, no, we got up to date new. I mean, I learned new stuff in this trial. Every trial you learn stuff. So I got some great stuff there. I mean, like you have limited time. You got to talk about those numbers. I mean, it's like 3 things. I think you got to earn their trust and build some rapport. You have to get them used to the idea of money for pain or impairment, as we use in Colorado, and get them ready for a big number. So we'll go into all that and how to do it and lots of fun video clips. Then I'm giving a lecture, one I've never given before. I'm doing just for this one. I've always wanted to do it. And it is how to use dramatic techniques in trial to make an effective presentation to the jury. And I do a workshop on this. I've done that for you a couple times, which is a lot of fun. And what's great on the workshop side of it is we can really, everyone practice it. And I teach 2 different, in that workshop, I teach 2 different techniques for both opening and closing, how to create space, something I learned from you and others, in opening and really create the scene. And then in closing, I talk about and I teach how to bring your client into the closing to make it personal and to create emotion in the courtroom. I mean, it's like they forget that there's a client there and there's so many ways to involve them in the process. You don't tell them ahead of time. And like, dude, I'd say like 1/4 of my closing is delivered to my client. And like, it always brings emotion. In this last trial, I did the rebuttal at the briefcase closed, Nick Rowley's briefcase. I do it my own little way, right? There's no original idea out there. We all steal someone else's and make it our own, sprinkle on our own little magic that we have. And I'd never done it in rebuttal before. And it was so, briefcase closed, Dan, you want to tell me the briefcase closes?
Man shows up, knocks on the door, you answer it, and he says, Kurt Zahner, I got this briefcase of money for you. And you're like, oh, nice, but hold on, there's some conditions. Well, what are those? Well, if you take this briefcase, you will have a broken spine. You will not be able to hold your kids. You will not be able to sleep at night because the pain will keep you up. You'll have to pop all these different Vicodins and medications just to numb the pain, which will also numb your brain. You will not ever be able to work again. You'll have to be dependent. You'll have to just receive money from others because you have no ability to take care of yourself anymore. And goes on and on, obviously, looking at the person. When you look, you know, name all the things that are fucked about their lives. And obviously, it's going to cause a lot of emotion because the person's living this life. You know what I mean? It's like you really bring it home to what this person's future is. And guess what? You don't have a choice. Person's like, I don't want it. I don't want the money. Sorry. The decision has been made by this big petroleum company that chose to put holes in their things. And the decision is made for you. So you have there's no option here. Folks, nobody would take that briefcase. But we have to place a value on this man's loss. And I say the number is $30 million.
That's good. Yeah, man. I did that. So I did that in rebuttal. I'd never done it before in rebuttal. And it was so much better because no one else said anything after that. And there's no, like,
right.
They don't get up. And like, I slam it down on the table. And no, you know, nobody takes that. And then like, then at the very end, I sit down. Then the emotion comes. So the jury's like silent, you know, and like we're right next to the jury because we're the plaintiffs, and like Steve's crying and I'm crying and the judge is like, now jury, you have a job to do. And I'm like, you know, holding back here. I'm like, oh, and the jury just walks out in silence. And me and Steve are just like holding back tears, crying. And it was just so powerful, man. So I'm doing my workshop. I'm teaching. The other thing I do in the workshop is closing. I talk to my client and deliver bad news to them about all their diagnoses and all the loss of hope, and they're going to lose their job. Sorry, Steve, but it turns out the two fractures in your leg haven't been able to heal correctly. And now you're going to live with debilitating nerve pain. And we're sorry, Steve, we don't really have a fix for that. We've tried different injections and the pain is just going to be there for the rest of your life. And we're sorry, but we think your best option is to amputate your foot. Because we're sorry, Steve, you're not going to be able to play with your daughter on the beach because the sand is going to sound and feel like fire on the bottom of your foot every time you step. So we do that. So I teach all that, give chance for everyone a chance to do it. So that's my workshop, but I'm also making a lecture this year. And I'm going to talk about using drama, using emotion, openings, closings, cross-examinations, directs, all these little things that I do that I enjoy, that I think work, and really lecture on that and give folks tips how to find their own self, who they are, and use these different techniques in trial to bring drama to the courtroom and to bring emotion to the courtroom. Because jurors, man, they usually end up liking me at the end. It's like I got Gladius somewhere. I'm here on the sword. It's like, are you not entertained? This is not what you came to see. I mean, they're used to TV lawyers, which is awesome. And then you get like boring lawyers and they're like, you can't even hold their attention. So you have to keep them engaged or you lose them. So we're going to teach on dramatic techniques to use in trial. That's the second lecture. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
All right. And you said your workshop was putting these techniques into action, correct?
Correct.
All right. And then next week, this gas and oil explosion case, we're going to do a case analysis on it on April 2nd, but this broadcast won't come out till past then. But the great news is that webinar where you break it down for 3 hours from voir dire to rebuttal will be recorded. And you're going to get us the transcripts, pleadings, and PowerPoints. Like, we do our best to collect those for every case. And it'll be on tluondemand.com, which is both a website and an app for your phone that you can use anywhere, any place, if you want to continue learning all the time. And, you know, this job, you just got to keep learning because there's so much stuff to know. And you got quite a few other presentations on there, too. We almost got our Kurt Zahner trial school going on there. Maybe one day. We're working on it. We got to get your 15-minute voir dire recorded live so people can actually see you doing it, because that helps too. Because it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to see a transcript. It's another thing to see the person actually do it. But transcripts are very helpful. So, you know, if you get all those things, all right, Mr. Zahner?
Yeah.
For the library, for the library.
We'll get it all uploaded, man. I'm excited to talk about it. It's so funny, Vore Dire, it's like, this is part I stress the least about. I literally look at my Vore Dire topics like the night before, because it really is conversation. And everyone has different challenges in trial. Like opening is my biggest challenge. I mean, it stresses the hell out of me. And then I stay up overnight. I can't get sleep over my opening. But jury selection, I mean, it's just that for me, whatever, it's like my piece. It's like an easy thing for me. I feel comfortable in it. And other parts of trial, I feel less comfortable. And so that's like, I don't know. Everyone's different. But I'd be like, man, I nail opening. Jury selection, that's tough. We're all learning from each other.
That's a great part. So let's talk about this 15 minutes of voir dire that you did in your oil and gas case, because it's pretty similar to the ones that, I mean, obviously, just like there are no original thoughts, there's not a whole lot of original voir dire coming down. Sometimes we got to come up with a new question or a new pattern for a particular case. But in general, things like money, burden of proof, rapport, sympathy, things like that, we've talked, you know, are generally part of most voir dires. So, but when you got 15 minutes and no time to schmooze, you still got to get that connection. So tell us what the 15-minute voir dire looks like. For those people who maybe can't make it to Huntington Beach, give them a little primer here. Although that's crazy if you don't make it to Huntington Beach. But by the time anybody hears this podcast, the hotel will most likely be sold out because there's only about 50 rooms left.
It's so cool, too, because everyone stays on site at Huntington Beach. It's not like they disperse. Dan provides food for everybody, lunch and breakfast. So you're constantly networking, man. So you're just getting to know people.
Well, and we bought out the entire hotel.
Yeah.
That's the dopest part, having the whole hotel.
Yeah.
You better have that cold plunge there. Everybody's counting that. People already sent me emails. We got the cold plunge this year. I said, I'm going to check with Zahner. I hope he's not going to start trying to save money on our, you know, conference.
So 15 minutes, right? The judge does
15 minutes. That's right.
The judge does their thing. And I get up and, you know, I introduce myself. I do my little soliloquy of you all showed up. Not everybody does. And thank you for doing that. There's no wrong answers here, that whole bit. Keith Bendick's got a great one about apple pie contests, and I think I used that in this one, pumpkin pie contest. If you hate pumpkin pie and you were asked to sit on a jury judging pumpkin pie, you probably wouldn't be the best judge since you hate pumpkin pie. Or maybe a better way to do it is there's a pie judging contest, and you know pumpkin pie will be one of the entries. You could not be a fair judge on that one because you hate pumpkin pie. And so look, all we're trying to do in these 15 minutes is figure out whether you are a good fit. And so you just have to answer honestly. And there's no like jury jail you're going to get sent to if you can't follow the law. It's okay to not be able to follow the law. That's okay. We just want you to tell us what your personal experiences are, your personal biases are, because that's what makes you a good juror and that's what makes you human. And we want good humans on this jury. And so we have to ask you these questions. And so you give them a little thing. I'm like, now, what's brutal honesty mean? My brutal honesty is that I'm nervous and I'm afraid I'm not going to do a great job for Steve, something like that. And I just start talking to them. I memorize their names ahead of time, which is way easier to do than you think.
You only got 8 jurors. I mean.
Yeah, you got 17, 18 usually, right? You have the whole panel you have to, because you talk to all those people. I've had jurors, Dan, come up to me at lunch breaks and say, hey, thank you for memorizing our names. It really means a lot that you cared about us. I was like, I can't talk to you right now. I'm sorry.
Like, say it to the hand. Sorry.
These jurors call. I had a juror in the Warrenburg case call afterwards and say, do we give him enough money, Mr. Zahner? I hope he gets all that money. I mean, like, these bonds start being created in jury selection when you memorize their names. So I ask them about brutal honesty. I pick on people. I don't make them raise their hands. You know, that's one way to show off you've memorized their name. And it's how you guarantee you get everyone involved. So I go from brutal honesty. And then I go quickly to jury empowerment. You know, how do you feel about being entrusted with this power? This is an important thing to set up closing when you empower them again. Then I go into lawsuit abuse and I talk about law. Do people think, okay, now you have this power, all these things build on each other. You've been empowered. Do you think the system works? And we talk about lawsuit abuse, both on the plaintiff side and the defendant side. Plaintiffs getting runaway juries, frivolous lawsuits. And then on the defense side, when the company is clearly responsible, they don't take responsibility or accountability. And they say, we're not going to pay you. We're going to hire our lawyers and we're going to go through your closet and look through everything in your life and blame you. That's also a lawsuit abuse. It's kind of fun to get that in there. I stole that one from Mark. I stole that one from Mark Lanier. No one ever objects to it. It's great. And the people say, and they say, what do you think, Mr. Smith? What do you think, Mr. Ambrose? You do the whole thing, the whole David Ball thing. Do you feel more like that? So we get now they're warmed up. That'll identify my tort reformers. Then I quickly go into the idea of money for pain or impairment. and get people talking about that. Some people, like my mom, thinks money for pain is crazy. It's like a nebulous concept. You can't measure it. There's not like a quantifiable way like with a medical bill. Some people don't feel comfortable with that, and that's okay. Other people say, well, that's the best we have. We can't create perfect justice. We can't spin that globe that backwards and undo the harm. All we can do is compensate for the harm. We can't inflict that harm that was caused to Steve onto BHS. That would be barbaric. We're not going to take away their president's leg. I mean, other societies used to do that, but we don't. Some people think money for pain is fine. So you go through that. Then I do a really quick thing in 15 minutes on preponderance of the evidence. And the only takeaway there that I want them to have is that this is the lowest burden in the justice system, as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt, as opposed to clear and convincing, which means highly probable or reasonably certain. We as plaintiffs have the lowest burden. And some people don't think that's fair. You know, how do you feel about that? You don't have the highest burden because we're not taking people's liberty away. We have the lowest burden because it's just about money. And who feels comfortable with that? And this is, I'll go through, it's a clunky one to do. Sometimes judges don't think I do a good job with it. But like, all I want them to come away with is that like, we don't have to prove it by much. We're going to do a lot more, prove by a whole lot more. But it's a really, really low burden. So I do that. And then I go into the amount I'm going to ask for. And I think it's really critical you do that at the end, and once you've built trust, as opposed to the beginning. The first time I asked for over 8 figures in jury selection, I did it, and I had an hour, but I did it right off the bat. And I was like, as I was so nervous about it, and I was like, we're going to ask for $16 million here. That's my brutal honesty. How do you feel about that? Or I said $20 million. I mean, I didn't ruin the case, but still got 16, so it wasn't like obviously fatal. But people, all they could think about for the next hour was that $20 million I asked for. And I had no credibility, and they were just, everything was viewed through that lens. It was one juror, Dan, in the front row, in Boulder. Boulder's like super liberal, so you're supposed to be accustomed to big verdicts. He was like leaning forward at me and like getting stuck, snarling at me. And I'm like, Judge, I'd like to move to get this guy out for cause. I'm a little afraid of him. The judge is like, I will strike juror number 7 for cause for the physical enmity he's displaying towards Mr. Zahner. So we got struck for cause because he hated my $20 million. So that's why I wait till the end to do it. And then I'll break it down at the workshop. But I do a lot of anchoring here. And I start with, now we're talking about something that's uncomfortable, and that's money, because that's all we can talk about. And some folks have a problem sitting on a jury where hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake. Let's take billion dollars. Let's take, for example, and I start with like two companies suing each other, Microsoft suing Apple for $5 billion for patent infringement. And we kind of start at the top there. And like, okay, company versus company, people don't feel so bad about big money there. But then some people start getting a little more uncomfortable when it's a person who's maybe suing a company for suing Microsoft for stealing his software idea for $3 billion and uses big numbers. People may even feel comfortable, even if the evidence is there that they stole it, awarding that much money. And so we go through that. And then we talk about paintings. We talk Mona Lisa. And we talk about the Mona Lisa being destroyed by someone's negligence. And we work in the facts of our case into this example. In this one, it was about, say the people transporting the Mona Lisa had one job, and that was just to package it correctly with like no holes in it. They had to have a secure package, right? No holes in the tanks in my explosion case. But they didn't package it the right way. They used these old packages that were 20 years old, that had holes in them, that were falling apart, and they shoved that Mona Lisa in there. And the Mona Lisa is clearly worth $600 million. Would anyone have a problem awarding $600 million if someone was clearly negligent in transporting and damaged the Mona Lisa? Because in this case, we're going to be asking for, I said $40 million, maybe it was $45 million. Having heard none of the evidence, is anyone just saying, I can't sit on a jury, even if the evidence proves it, I can't sit in a jury that awards that kind of money to someone? The evidence shows I'm happy doing that. And this goes a lot of different ways, Dan. Sometimes you just get, this jury, man, they didn't bat an eye. They were like, yeah, sounds good. Reasonable. Maybe they're lying. I don't know. You never know. This is two parts. It's to get them used to the number and okay with it, and to try and find people that hate this idea. And many trials have done the exact same thing. People get really angry. Like I said, you can get rid of them. So you have to go through those things. You don't have to all those things, but those things I can get to in 15 minutes.
Great. And just in case people cannot make it to Huntington Beach, we are going to be in Vegas October 16th through 19th. That'll be our third time there. It's our third time in Huntington Beach. So this will be at Caesar's Palace. Hopefully, Kurt will be able to bless us with his presence there. We're going to talk to our federal judges, make sure they clear out his docket to make a cameo there in Vegas with us. It's going to be pretty fun. It's going to be great. Now, let's shift gears for a second because that was voir dire, but I know you fancy yourself quite the deposition taker. Is there some truth in this?
I absolutely do.
Tell us why. What makes you so, well, at least think you're so good at depositions?
Because I'm kind of a jerk.
Oh, I know it after 7 years. Trust me.
I make them answer the question. It can oftentimes take me an hour to get the answer I'm looking for. I go into these things. I take every minute they allow me. Some lawyers in and out. Man, you get your best answers like in that fourth and fifth and sixth hour when they're just worn.
You start to wear them down.
Yeah. So just,
they lost their fight. They forgot what answer they're supposed to give.
Dude, I had this case. I have to tell a story. It's so good. I'll tell why I like it. It was State Farm bad faith case, State Farm Auto. And I broke down this adjuster who was the corporate rep for, you know, it was like 6:30 at night, last minutes of the depo. And I was like, ma'am, I can send the depo clip. It's hilarious. I was like, ma'am, do you think that State Farm treated their insured like a good neighbor here? And she's like, a good neighbor. She's like, well, I don't know. What do you mean by that? I go, well, I don't know. What do you mean by that? You're speaking on behalf of State Farm. It's your slogan. And she's like, a good neighbor. She's like thinking to herself, someone who's there for you when you need them. Someone who treats you fairly, someone who is kind. No, we didn't. You did not treat your insured like a good neighbor? No, we didn't. Thank you. That's all the questions I have for today. That case, they had offered like 5,000 pre-suit and it settled for many seven figures. It was crazy, man. It was so depots are where you win the case, not just good for settling, but for trial. Like we're preparing every case for trial. I don't take a lot of cases anymore. I'm blessed to be able to just find these great ones and just work them up. I think they're all going to trial and a lot of them are. And so in depositions, I got to know the universe of documents better than anybody else. And in a depo, I'm doing two things. I'm learning things. I'm just generally learning about the case. And I'm also getting admissions. What wins cases aren't complex causation arguments. It's bad behavior by the defendants. And so you have to figure out what they've done wrong. You've got to figure out their policies, their missteps. You got to find any inconsistencies in their stories between one corporate rep and another employee, because that's the gold. When you start catching them in lies, they lose all credibility. And so in these depos, what my plan always is to create a depo clip sheet from the depo where I need clean answers. I get this 2-page answer. I follow. Okay. So what you're saying for a clear record is X, Y, and Z. That's right. Then you take that as a clip and now you have the basis. And usually for each witness, I have between 70 and 120 clips, sometimes 200, ready for cross-examination at trial. And then I draft my cross-examination at trial and I have the clips all lined up. And you don't know when they're going to start lying about what they said before. And maybe it's something inconsequential. But if you've got these great clips from the deposition, then you have a cross-examination and you get to play these video clips when they stray just a little bit. And it is powerful. This last trial, I cut with my tech guy, I think 1,100 clips from deposition.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, it's brutal. You got to go through all the depos and I got to figure out, here's the clip. Then you put those into a cross-examination and create a cross-examination where you still have the flexibility to free will, because that's the most fun. And then you hit them, man. Dude, the first three witnesses in this case didn't play a single clip. Witness four, oh man, started hitting clips. And it was just like, wow. I mean, maybe the less clips you play, even the more powerful. And then they lose all credibility. And so the depos are just so critical to get the answers, get real answers to your questions, and to create a clean record to create the depo clips. And that's why I usually take expert depos, because I want to know what they're going to say and I want to lock them in, at least on the liability side. Damages side, not as important.
Recently, because like Kurt and I go way back and he did my Trojan Horse Method program a long time ago, and I'm still trying to persuade him to come and do my new boot camp, but Kurt is a tough, tough cookie. It's okay though, especially because it's like people too, my boot camp, like this is like acting for trial lawyers. I'm like, duh, it's a performance. That's what it is. I mean, it's an authentic performance, but it's still a performance. But I am going to share something with you. I think it's the first time I shared it on a podcast or a webinar, but we wrote this great cross-examination of the defense medical expert, but it could be, it's a pattern cross that could be adapted to any expert to lay out the rules. So you're going to be Dr. Zahner, and I'm going to give it to you because I think that you're going to be appreciated. You tell me, because like you're the expert. You're Mr. So I want you to be brutally honest with me when I'm done with my cross, okay?
Far away.
Because like I think the skills that are important to learning cross are the basics, obviously leading questions, one new fact per question. We can agree on that. Looping. We can agree looping's a good skill to have, right? Mm-hmm. But you got to practice it. Being able to cross-examine in the present tense, causing you to visualize your story, causing your witness to visualize it, causing the jury to visualize the story is an important skill. Dropping the taglines like right, correct, isn't it true? Dropping all the filler words that most people have, like and, every sentence begins, for most lawyers, begins with an and ends with an and, so all those filler words. Using a flip chart to anchor your points. Did you use a flip chart in this trial, Kurt?
I did use a flip chart. It was the first time I used a flip chart in a long time, and I will never not use a flip chart again.
Oh.
Amazing.
But it takes practice to get comfortable using it, to learn how to write legibly. These are skills that take practice. Using your hand to control the pace of the witness's answer. So when it's out, you're talking, you pause for a second, you're done, then you drop it. Now the witness psychologically knows it's time to answer. So you can draw out, you can hold, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If your hand's up there, the person's not going to answer. So it leads them a little more time to let those, to pacing, pausing. So many people on cross, first of all, they get aggressive. As soon as this cross, it's like, you're Kurt Zahner. You know what I mean? Instead of just like controlling your facial expressions, like I think on foundational cross, when you're just laying the base, it's good to have like a curious look. Like I'm a conduit for learning for our group of people here called the jury, because I really don't know about the stuff I'm asking you, with that curious face, like inquisitive look. So those are skills I want you to pay attention to during your cross-examination. Okay, Dr. Zahner?
Yes, sir.
All right, ready? Here we go. Doctor, you're board certified.
I am.
To become board certified requires advanced education.
Certainly does.
This education, it takes place in medical school.
Yes.
In medical school, you take classes.
Yes.
One of the classes that you take is on how to conduct a proper medical evaluation.
I believe we took some classes on that. That's right.
You're trained that a proper medical evaluation must be impartial.
Of course.
And by impartial, what we mean is that you're not an advocate for either side.
That's right.
Doctor, you're trained that a proper medical evaluation must not only be impartial, but it must also be objective.
That's right.
By objective, what we mean is you don't cherry pick the medical records to reach a desired opinion.
No, we wouldn't do that.
Doctor, you're trained that a proper medical evaluation must not only be impartial and objective, but it must also be complete.
Correct.
By complete, what we mean is that you consider all relevant information.
That's right.
Doctor, the opposite of a proper medical evaluation, when that's impartial, objective, and complete, will that be a biased evaluation?
That's one way you could look at it.
By a biased evaluation, what we're talking about, that's the type of evaluation where a paid expert chooses to only consider information that supports a desired opinion and ignores everything else.
More or less, yeah.
Doctor, you're trained and you know that there are certain risks associated with a paid expert's choice to conduct a biased medical evaluation.
There can be.
Well, one of those risks is that the jury could be misled about the patient's condition.
Yeah.
Doctor, you're trained that if a paid expert chooses to conduct a biased medical evaluation, not only could the jury be misled about the patient's condition, but the jury could also be misled about the extent of the patient's injuries.
Quite possible.
Doctor, you're trained that if a paid expert chooses to conduct a biased medical evaluation, not only could the jury be misled about the patient's condition, the extent of the patient's injuries, but perhaps worst of all, to undervalue the human damages and suffering that were caused.
Possible.
So doctor, here's my question. On December 14th, 2020, you had a choice. So tell us all, what did you choose to do? I mean, did you choose to conduct a proper medical evaluation when that was impartial, objective, and complete, like you were trained to do? Or did you choose to violate your training and conduct a biased evaluation, knowing all the risks.
You want the truth?
Can you handle the truth? So anyways, so that with the flip chart, obviously I don't have a flip chart here because we're on a, you know, a webinar, but you would put down improper and then number one, impartial when you wrote it. And they put a number two after it, causing curiosity for the jury, like what else is coming? And then put objective, number three, complete. So that way you're constantly visually anchoring and looking at it with your glance, causing the jury to look at it. And then you flip the paper, it makes a big freaking noise, biased evaluation, the risk involved, the word choice, because now certain risks associated with a paid expert. Now I'd be calling the guy a paid expert's choice. This isn't accidental. To conduct a biased evaluation. And you work the word patient in there too. So now we got the defense medical examiner calling our client the patient. So that's a good thing. I feel that's a very sound cross, but I'm not the master like you. So
I love that.
Because it really lays a line in the sand, because every expert, how many defense experts have you come across who weren't at, who didn't try to be advocates for the defense, who didn't cherry pick the medical records / all the evidence, and considered all the all relevant information? It never happens, never. Because, and the fact that they know the risks if they choose to do these things, and they do it anyways, because the beauty of this cross is it draws a line in the sand. The jury already knows you, right? They know you're about to fuck this guy up. But this guy knows you're about to fuck him up too, because he's not used to this, right? He's used to just tap dancing around with unprepared plaintiff's lawyers that don't have a focus, that they could play word games with. And for most experts, it's a game. Fucking with the plaintiff's lawyer is a game. And so it's like, I always thought to myself in criminal law, when I used to get up against a cop, I'd be like, are you a better liar than I am cross-examiner? We're about to find out. By drawing that line, it engages the jury, because like Roger Dodd says, the jury ain't interested in a fish that don't flop, right? The jury wants to see a fight. A verbal fight. And at this time, let's hopefully they're on our side and you're kind of like their hero. So they're cheering for, they're like, yeah, fuck this liar up. You know what I mean? And so your jury engagement is obviously very important. And it's like an early foundational chapter. I just think that, and it can be adjusted for any expert too, which is the great part about it, right? It's flexible. Every expert is supposed to be impartial, objective, and complete. Every expert. If an expert just got to stand and say, excuse me, Mr. Zahner, before you start questioning me, I need the jury to know that I'm biased, I'm paid for, I'm bought. I have this beautiful house in Vail that I love to go skiing at, and it was $5 million, and the money I make being a paid whore expert, it pays for it. So just so everybody know that before you start questioning me, it might save you some time on some of the biases you might want to point out. I mean, if they would just do that, we could save a lot of time, right? But the problem is they don't do that. They lie, and doctors and cops are very similar, is that we as a society place them on a very high pedestal and give them the benefit of every doubt because they keep us safe. That's why I think cross-examining them is important, to raise them up. That's why you call them doctor, officer, doctor, you know, that term of respect. And because the jury respects them, they don't know what a piece of shit the person is right before you do the cross. Even if you laid some foundations in your opening, they still just heard for an hour how brilliant this person is and how he's just here to tell the truth and properly inform the jury. So anyways, give me a little benefits of some work we were doing, Zahner. And so, if anybody ever wants a copy of this cross, like the transcript / I made some videos for it too, just to help people with the presentation, shoot me an email or text me. My email's dan@triallawyersuniversity.com. Of course, my cell phone's 248-808-3130. And I'll be happy to get you that stuff. So I thought I would share a little knowledge with you, Kurt, since you shared so much with us so far. But before we go, because we're getting near that time, I need to know about Wim Hof.
Wim Hof. By the way, I think that cross was great. I like how it's simple in the beginning. You get good answers. You lock him in. You get him used to saying yes. All that stuff is great. Send me the cross. I need that. Sometimes I overcompensate on technique with flair. And so sometimes it's good to drill down back into the basics. So
I'll get you that. That'd be part of your compensation for your appearance fee here at the Trial Lawyers University webinar.
Cross is fun. In the last trial I was a federal court, so a lot of like limitations where you can move. I couldn't go in front of the podium for anything except for like giving something to the witness. But I used that whole defense table, my table. I was walking back and forth, pointing at them, pointing over there. Oh, dude, it was a blast. We'll go over that, the TLU thing too, in Huntington Beach. But Wim Hof.
Wim Hof.
So being a lawyer is very stressful. It's very hard. You know, you listen to these podcasts, you're like, oh man, that guy loves the law. He's crushing it. And wow, but my experience is different. It's really hard. My experience is very hard. I struggle with the stress and the work of it. It's legit, man. There's just so much to do. To do things the right way, it just takes time. And if you, like you said earlier, want to do other things in life, like I have three little boys, 8, 6, and 2. I have a wife. I have a martial arts practice. I don't have 18 hours in a day to work, but that's what it feels like it need to do this job the right way. And so I'm always looking for the cheat codes, man. Like I'm to dial down my stress levels and my anxiety levels and boost up my mental health. And so it's a healthy cocktail of clean eating, of exercising, and then Wim Hof has really introduced me to cold exposure and to breathing techniques. And he's this guru. I'm not a guru, but he's a guru from the Netherlands. Look him up. Listen to, pick your favorite podcast. I'm sure he's on it. Dan, you should have him on this podcast. It would be amazing. I'm sure he would do it.
Is he a buddy of yours?
No, but like he's on all the podcasts. He's got to be on yours. And quick note on him. So his is really sad. His four children, his wife killed herself, jumped out of a hotel window after kissing her kids goodbye. And he's like, I'm going to find a way to help mental health that doesn't include a pharmacological option. And so he designed the Wim Hof technique to help people create their zen and to just dial into life and tune out the stress. And cold exposure and breathing are a huge part of that. And I'm a devout follower on the cold exposure. I wax and wane on the breathing stuff, but I have a cold tub at my house every morning. I plunge for 2 to 3 minutes in 45 degree water. It just clears your head. The endorphin rush, the psychological benefit. There's all sorts of physical benefits too, from creating healthy brown fat, which is what you need and helps you stay warm in cold weather, to cardiovascular health. It's just incredible, man. So I'm a big advocate of that.
All right, because I'm getting a cold plunge tub in my bathroom so that I can plunge on a regular basis. Because I don't, as you may have noticed here, I don't have a backyard here. I'm a backyard 200 feet in the air. So we're not going to be doing that. But I'm looking forward to this. And I hope it gets, because those things are not cheap. I mean,
no,
at all.
No.
They are pricey.
You can make them. If you're handy, it's pretty easy to make out of an ice chest and a chiller.
Okay. I'm not going to make one for my bathroom. Okay. If I had a backyard and a garage, then I would do that. But the bathroom is going to have like a regular tub in it, because it has to have some aesthetic pleasingness to it. Absolutely. Got to be a little aesthetically pleasing. So the only thing we did talk about, how do you think, you're a big martial arts guy too. You're like, what's that called? That guy that's like the, what's that word? I can't think of it, but it means like you're like the modern man, you know, with the family, the practice, the karate, the martial arts, the ice. You're Renaissance man. That's what you are. You're a Renaissance man. You're like, you know what? I'll take it.
All day.
I'm over at his house. He's got these swords. He's swinging around. I'm like, just keep 10 feet away from me before you stab me. It's one of those things. So what's up with the Kenpo?
Kenpo, yeah. So Kenpo is a Hawaiian martial art that is from the Hawaiian Islands. It's a blend of karate, kung fu, and a little bit of jujitsu. I got into it because at the time, my 5-year-old, who's now 8, started it. And I was like, well, it'd be cool to like learn along with him. And now 3 years later, man, like I love it. I created a little dojo in my house. It's mainly a striking martial art. And I do an hour private lesson every week. I do half an hour with my children and our sensei. It's such a good disconnect. I put the phone down. It's mentally challenging, remembering all these different kung fu forms, which can be like a minute long. It's hard. I've picked up weapons where I'm pretty good with the bow staff and pretty good with the spear. And I was motivated to do this. We have time for this last quick story. Kind of bookend this thing with that motorcycle trial. The guy who died going 88 miles per hour. It was during the time of Game of Thrones. And there's this wonderful scene in Game of Thrones where this guy's about to be killed and he needs to have like a battle on his behalf and someone needs to be his champion. And this guy who's like his arch rival comes in. His name is the Viper of Dorne. And he's this martial artist. He's great with a spear. And there's this beautiful scene where the guy thinks he's going to be just left alone. No one's going to fight for him. And the Viper of Dorne comes in and gives this beautiful speech, moving. He's like, I will be your champion. And I would watch this scene every morning of trial during that motorcycle case as a way to motivate me, because I felt like I needed to be this family's champion. No one was fighting for them. No one wanted the case. And their justice depended on me. Because in this scene, the Viper of Dorne, he's like, and what about justice? And Tyrion's like, if you want justice, you've come to the wrong place. And he's like, I disagree.
everyone that has wronged me is right here. And it will begin with Sir Gregor Clegane, who killed my sister.
And that's the guy that's going to, he has to fight on behalf of this other guy. And so there's a great fight. So it's like, oh my gosh. That's, in fact, I have it behind me, if you can see, a plaque with Ghaffar's name, the kid who died, and his birth date and his name. And it says, I will be your champion. Because that's what the guy, Viper of Dorne, told Tyrion. And so the Viper of Dorne is a spear master. And so now I know how to use the spear. And it motivated me to learn the spear. I can twirl it and swing it and throw it. Oh, it's great, man. So it's just a wonderful way to disconnect from the law, work on something physical, and as self-defense gives me confidence and learn new things and also share it with my family, man. So we were practicing last night, some of our Kenpo. So it's just awesome, man. It's a great way to do something other than write legal briefs and argue in court.
That is pretty awesome. And in Huntington Beach, you know, like my boot camp that I developed here, we're going to be doing a 3-day version of it, June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. But I know you won't be there for that, but you should do a half a day version of it, Zaner. Humor me. He's resistant to a lot of things. And even though he is, I still love him. I don't judge him for his resistance. It's hard-headed. The more successful people often get, the more hard-headed they become until they break through on something. They're like, oh, this is great. I wish you would have shown this to me a long time ago. I'm like, whatever. That's okay. We tried. I'm just saying, Zaner, half a day, and you're going to practice on Zoom ahead of time because you only know what you know, and know that you know a lot. But we'll see if you can know a little bit more. Just throwing it out there, Zaner.
I'll do half day cross exam. Let me know.
Half a day.
I want to do the craft. Okay. I want to do that.
Deal. I'll send it to you when we're done. We'll talk. All right.
Finding blood. Awesome.
Cross exam. I know. I can't wait to get back in the court with myself. It's been there recently, about 6 months ago. It was a good experience. They need a little better cases next time than an intentional tort bar fight. Not the easiest case where you don't have any injuries except a scar on a guy's forehead who has tattoos all over his face. I'm like, give me a challenge. I'm like, bro, the scar, but it is what it is. And it was challenging. We learned a lot, but we are ready to get, especially with the cross-examination. Looking forward to that, Zaner. Looking forward to seeing you too. And we got some prep to do before next week. So we're going to get on that. And I think that's pretty much everything I needed to cover with you. I mean, this is not our standard format. Our standard format is a little different than this, but you're such a colorful guy. I got permission from the higher ups at TLU to divert from our standard format. The board gave me permission. I said, we got this character, Zaner. Can we go off script? And they said, you know what? Let me see his background. Okay. Because as long as we got some good Nordsman quotes and swords and stuff like that, that's all we need. Perfect, buddy.
That was awesome, dude.
It's perfect. Well, I know you got some more podcasts you're going to be on with, who else are you going to go see? Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravapudi. And
they were very kind to connect me on that one.
Oh, yeah. I've been on there twice. I don't want you to be jealous.
No.
Only person that's been on there twice. And then Keith Fuseli, and he's in Colorado.
Yeah,
guy, right?
Colorado guy. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Hopefully he'll come out. He's been to Vegas before. I know that. They got a Fuseli and Lee, right? They got a good little firm there. So he's been to Vegas for a conference. I don't think he's been to Huntington Beach.
Yeah.
So when you talk to him, make sure you invite him, because
I will.
You be the voice, because you can be objective about it. And it's objectively the greatest conference on earth. So objectively.
No disagreement here.
And that was last year. This year's going to blow it out. We got food trucks every night. We got Ken and Barbie theme party on Thursday. Western theme party on Friday. Vegas theme party Saturday. Because, you know, we got to close out this conference where we open up the next one in Vegas. Vegas, October 16th, for those golfers. Claggett's Brent booked the entire country club called Bally High for 150 people to play 18 holes. So that's pretty cool, because Claggett's a hell of a golfer. I saw golf with him yesterday. The guy fucking crushes the ball. Like, big. Like, you'd surprise he's got so much time to be a trial lawyer, because as good as he has his golf game, because that's, he's got a family and kids too. And they're important to him too. And he replaces golf with Kempo, I think.
There you go. You find
you do Kempo, you go. Everybody's got to have their thing. Perfect.
That's right. Dude, Claggett's good at everything. No surprise, he's great at golf. The guy's a stud.
Yeah, he's really good at golf. So,
yeah.
Really good at golf. And what he's teaching at Huntington Beach, I mean, it's 3 days of the Claggett and Sykes Trial College, like how they do it. How they do it from intake to rebuttal. It's very detailed. You should take a look at that agenda. It's like, I am impressed, because not too many big-time lawyers are really willing to dig deep to show you how they do it. Everybody wants the showtime stuff, the voir dire, the opening, the stuff that's sexy, that's important for trial. But everybody knows trials are won way before you walk into that courtroom. Won or lost. And it's all in the preparation. And to spend 3 days, a total of 18 hours, just laying out that is going to be awesome. But and with the workshops and stuff, you can't see everything, but the entire conference is being recorded. I mean, all the lectures will be on TLU On Demand. So when you're in other places teaching stuff, good news, Zahner, there's still access to all this brilliance on TLU On Demand. So
love it. I'm all in.
All right. Can't wait, buddy. All right. I'll see you soon, and I'll see you next on the second, but we'll see you before then prep, okay?
Thank you so much for having me. Let me leave you my favorite scripture that helps me with my daily life and being a trial lawyer. It's Philippians 4:13, where Tebow used to wear on his eyes during Florida football games. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I'll leave you on that. Thank you so much.
And Kurt also is spiritual and somewhat religious on top of all these other things. Praying for guidance. Jeez, what a guy. It's just, who can't love you, man? Seriously, it's weird. I mean, most people want to hate you because you're so everything besides being brilliant, just handsome too. It's not fair, but life is not always meant to be fair. So, all right, Zahner, good hanging out with you. I will be seeing you soon.
Awesome, dude. Thanks, Dan. It was a lot of fun, man. Appreciate it.
You got it.
Cheers.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at triallawyersuniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to tluondemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by LawPods.